little, even I don't need to hear.
For the Chinese girls in my school, no question is more important than the color of their skin. Who has a complexion as pale as the moon? One girl, a red princess, and the great-granddaughter of someone who walked side by side with Mao on the Long March, okay, we get it, you're a big deal, wins that prize hands down. I know lots of girls whose mothers take them to doctors for treatments to lighten their skin.
Lighten their skin? How do they do that?
And all the American-born and Chinese-born girls make fun of us adopted Chinese girls because darker skin marks us as the daughters of peasants.
My skin is darker, but I also look different than the other girls. Not Chinese enough, they say.
So we're talking about perception.
It makes me so mad. I guess that's why my mom and dad sent me here.
Dr. Rosen, aren't those stereotypes, though?
Oh, God, not another brainiac. How old are you again?
What do you mean, Ariel?
Well, Chinese used to be seen as low, right? Working on the railroad and laundries and stuff like that. Now they're seen as smart and wealthy. I mean, isn't there the stereotype of the model minority? I read an article for school that said people like us, not you, Dr. Rosen, are now labeled as inquisitive, persistent, and ambitious, with ingenuity, fortitude, and cleverness.
Jesus, kid, you won't even have to take that stupid SAT prep course. You've already got all the big words down cold.
All I'm saying is that there's no underestimating how cruel girls can be to each other. I've been reading about it because I'm scared of... Dr. Rosen, I don't know if I should say this.
Please, go ahead. I want you to think of this as a safe place.
I'm afraid of girls like... well, like Jessica. Is that why my parents sent me here? To toughen me up? I can be tough. Really, I can. Or is there another reason, Dr. Rosen? You'd tell me, wouldn't you?
Each of you is here for her own reason. What I feel comfortable sharing with all of you is that each of your parents wants you to be happy. Now, we've talked about a lot of different things today, but I'd like to circle back to a couple of themes that have emerged.
Like none of us can sleep?
I'm happy you picked up on that, Haley.
I've always crept around the house in the middle of the night, which is how I've heard my parents arguing about work, about this one woman who's dad's client and what to do about me.
For me, it's stress, obviously, at school and at home. It seems like my whole life I've spent the hours from 2 to 6 in the morning awake, staring at the muted TV screen, obsessively doing my homework, and trying to learn to knit to do something productive, as my dad said. He bought me knitting lessons for one of my birthdays. Knitting lessons. And Jessica isn't the only one who drinks. I sneak gulps from the wine left over at dinner. My parents are so stupid, they've never even noticed. I've smoked weed in the backyard. I had another doctor before you, Dr. Rosen, who prescribed me Ambien.
I just can't sleep. My mom says it's because I'm still on China time.
Hardy har har.
What happens when it's time for you to sleep?
Sometimes when I turn off the light, I feel myself start to wake up. I'm flying out the window and across the ocean to my orphanage in China. I see rows and rows of cots and Chinese ladies like the waitresses at Empress Pavilion who push the dim sum carts, walking up and down. I imagine the moment when I was loaded onto a bus or a truck and brought to the hotel. I bet I was scared. I bet I was crying already. Mom and Dad said it was like plop, plop, plop as each baby was dropped into a new mother's arms. Did I go to the right mom and dad? Is there something wrong with me, and that's why I look different from the other babies given out that day? Different from the other girls and families with children from China? Different from my friends at school? Then I have to turn the light back on.
Dr. Rosen, I don't get this. I know a lot of girls from Heritage Camp for adoptive families who don't have a single problem. They're all happy. Or they look that way to me.
She's right, you know. I've known the girls in FCC since we were babies. They don't let the stupid things people say get to them. I remember this one girl. We were like 8 years old. A stranger asked her if she was a foreign exchange student. That kind of thing really bugs me, but you know what she answered? Most exchange students are not 8 years old.
Have you ever been asked why you don't speak English with a Chinese accent? I have. I hate when people ask if I know English or if I've adjusted to America yet. Come on.
In our church, we have a group that's special for girls like us. Adopted, but from Russia and Romania and places like that. We had a meeting where we were supposed to learn how to respond to jerks who ask things like, when did you know you were adopted? Most people picture a scene where the parents sit you down and you find out who you are. I didn't need that meeting to know how to answer because all I had to do was look in the mirror. When people ask me that question, I always say, when did you find out you weren't adopted? How do you know your mother is your birth mother?
That seems a bit snarky. I'm just saying.
You could try something like the phenotypic differences between my parents and myself were always evident. I can only guess at how it would feel to be a biological child or be born white to match my parents.
Phenotypic differences?
I did a project for my school science fair on that. I won...
I hate to interrupt, Haley. Do you mind? Jessica, you've been unusually quiet. Would you like to share what's going on with you?
I've been thinking about what Ariel said earlier about me. Does everyone here think I'm a bully or mean or...
You act tough, but I bet you're as scared as the rest of us.
I'm not scared. Of what?
I'm going to step in here. I know from listening today that you girls don't like labels. I don't particularly like labels either, but my profession, like most professions, uses them. So let's take a moment to consider one that's being applied to Chinese adoptees, like the four of you.
Great. Just what I need. Another label. What are you going to call me?
Does the phrase grateful but angry have resonance for anyone? You could be grateful you have your mom and dad because they love you and they've given you good lives with all kinds of privilege.
Some more than others?
So, the grateful part seems pretty obvious, and as Ariel pointed out, there are many adoptees who are perfectly happy.
Most of them, I bet.
That's probably because they weren't born with brains.
But often, adoption is about loss. Loss of your original family, loss of culture and nationality, and of course, loss of a way of life that might have been. This is where the angry part comes in. Now, just today, you've shared lots of variations on anger and why you might be angry. Now, my profession narrows it down to this, anger that your birth parents abandoned you. So the label is grateful but angry, but in our private sessions, you've heard me talk about anger in a different way. Haley, do you remember what I said?
You said anger can be a cover for something deeper.
Do you want to share what that was for you?
Sadness. Really bad sadness, because somewhere out there, I had a mother and a father who didn't love me enough to keep me. They gave me away. They got rid of me. For their one child, they didn't want me. I've never had a way to grieve for that. I mean, how can I be around Mom and Dad, who I love a ton, and cry for my birth Mom and Dad because I don't know them or have them in my life? At the same time, why wasn't I good enough for my mom and dad in China? Now I have to work really hard, and not just with my classes, to be someone they would have been proud of if they'd known me. And for my mom and dad to be proud of now.
You mean I'm sad because my birth mother cared so little about me that she left me in front of a train station? By myself. In the middle of the night, in winter. And she didn't even want to know me.
Who wouldn't be sad when you put it like that?
I'm not sad, I'm pissed!
Youth in Asia.
Fuck this! God damn it!
I'm sorry I made you cry.
That's okay. I think that's what we're supposed to do in here. And by the way, Haley, don't pay attention to what I said earlier. You're probably gonna do a lot of stuff I do. The drinking and all. But take it from me on the true down low. Keep up with your homework. Don't forget to do some extracurriculars and don't get caught, okay? Don't get caught. And I'll try to be nicer to kids like you. It's just kind of hard for me.
All right, girls. I'm afraid our time is up. This was a good first session. Can I count on all of you to come again next week?
Breathe, breathe, breathe. Jin, his mother, Tea Master's son, Deja, and I returned to Springwell Village at the beginning of March 2008. just before the start of tea-picking season. My mother-in-law, who has not one good memory of life in the countryside, makes quite an impression on Ama and the sisters-in-law when she volunteers to haul water on her first morning. Mrs. Chang will do anything to be with her son and the child growing inside me. I'm 6 months pregnant, and my baby, let it be a son, rolls and kicks and jabs. He stretches against my lungs, pushes a foot on the inside of my ribcage, and leans on my bladder. Ama makes sure I eat her special soups with pig's feet, dates, and peanuts to nourish him and me. As for Deja, I was prepared to pay the fee to the headmen, village elders, Nima, and Ruma for whatever sacrifices and ceremonies might have been required, as did Sitte for her brother, to allow Deja back in the village. Although the birth of her human rejects was brought up by the Ruma during the clash with Sitte, not a soul, and by that I mean everyone but Ama, and she won't say a word knowing how Deja cares for me, recognizes her. She had been married into Springwell Village for barely a year when her twins were born. 20 years have passed, and her life has been very hard. She looks older than Ama, and stranger than anyone people have seen on their televisions with her new dentures. If we lived entirely by the old ways, what I am doing would be a violation of Aka law. But if her human rejects had been born today, they wouldn't have met their sorrowful ends, and she and Sido wouldn't have been banished. Deja and I aren't taking any chances, though. We will keep her identity a secret. Fortunately, Deja is a common name, and Sido and his new family are on a trip. The Ruma and Nima announce the day to begin picking. Early on that morning, when it's still dark, I'm asked to say a few words. What is stranger, that half the village stands before me, or that this worthless girl has overcome her past? And the risks are great for all of us. What we're doing has to work, or else Sitte will take over. I begin with what Tea Master Sun taught me. If you don't love tea, you can't make good tea, I recite. Our tea trees are gifts from God. We can see the Aka way in them. If you have cloned terrace bushes, one gets sick and they all get sick. Same with pollarded trees, which are so weakened by the brutality of constant trimming. But when we find a wild tea tree, we know certain things. It has been strong enough to survive and grow on its own. It has its own separate and unique genetic makeup. If one tree gets sick, others surrounding it are unaffected. We Aka understand this because we have a taboo against close relatives marrying. This is why we recite the lineage. People murmur their agreement, understanding what's beneath my words. Purity, not counterfeits. As we pick today, let's remember our progress can only be slow, one bud set at a time. If we find perfect leaves, the tea we make will be the best. Together, we'll share the Aka way with the outside world. When I step off the platform, Teacher Zong approaches.
May I help?
He asks. I hand him a basket, and he joins us as we walk up the mountain, guided by the last of the moonlight. The sun comes out, and still we work, breaking only to have tea and eat rice balls. Once our baskets are full, we return to the village, where Tea Master Sun oversees laying out the leaves for their first rest. The next day is even longer. We pick leaves and lay them out for their sunbath. Then we spend hours tossing 6-kilo batches of yesterday's rested leaves over walks to kill the green. After 14 hours, we sit outside together, families with families, eating meals prepared by those daughters-in-law who have remained in the village to care for the children too old to breastfeed and too young to help. On the third morning, who should arrive? Mr. Huang and his son.
"I'm on spring break,"
Xianrong announces, peeling out of the SUV. He's as skinny as ever and a little pale, the last probably from the ride through the turns, bumps, and ruts of the mountain.
"And I'm looking."
I hold up a hand to stop Mr. Huang from uttering another word. "Don't say it."
"To help,"
Mr. Huang finishes with a grin. He wears a straw hat, a rumpled shirt unbuttoned halfway down his chest, khaki pants that he's rolled up to his knees to keep cool, and plastic sandals. Tea Master Sun rushes forward to shake hands.
"Old friend, young friend, so good to see two such expert tasters."
The men exchange cigarettes, not that any of them smoke, as a gesture of friendship and cordiality. Mr. Huang is as disconcerting to me as he's always been, and I'll always be uncomfortable around him. But if Tea Master Sun trusts him, then maybe I should try to trust him a little bit. As for the boy, Ama has already pulled him inside and is probably serving him one of her special brews before they go picking, continuing the friendship they've had since he and his father first came to our village. The rest of us pick up baskets, sling them over our shoulders, and begin the long hike up the mountain to the tea trees. The next 8 days are our busiest, as we pick the first flush of leaves and process them. Once this is finished, Mr. Huang and Xianrong prepare to return to Hong Kong. The boy looks better than when he arrived, less pale and with a little weight from first sister-in-law's good cooking. And, of course, Mr. Huang asks about my hidden grove, and I complete our customary ritual by refusing to show it to him. Some things will never change. I pass on to my Abba and brothers and other men in the village what I learned at the tea college. My plan, as was Mr. Huang's all those years ago, involves separating our leaves into two batches. One for Mao Cha, the semi-processed tea that people will be able to drink as is or let age naturally, the other artificially fermented. For now, we convert the two largest drying sheds in Springwell into fermentation rooms. The semi-processed tea is built up into piles a half meter high. We sprinkle them with water, cover them with burlap, and let the natural heat of decomposition begin to do its work. I know all is going well when bees begin to hover outside, so attracted are they to the sweet and warm scent. There's no evidence of mold or the sour odor of rot. Instead, the piles smell of earth and life, ripe apples and pollen. These two sets of tea will later be steamed, pressed into cakes, set outside on trays for another round of drying, and finally wrapped in our new Springwell Village wrappers made of the finest rice paper. Every evening, Tea Master Sun brews and pours tea for us. Ama, Abba, Mrs. Chang, Teacher Zong, who is made to laugh in a way no one has seen before by my mother-in-law, and my brothers gather around the table along with Jin and me. We test the astringency of each batch of tea every 3 days to see how it's progressing. These are happy times with my family, even though the sisters-in-law must remain apart as custom dictates. My favorite moments, though, are those spent with the women in my family, doing a task that I always considered the most monotonous, sorting every single leaf into different grades. Yellow or defective leaves can be made into a low-grade tea for retired teachers, factory workers, and farmers in other provinces that we'll sell for 40 yuan a kilo. The best leaves, and there are so few, are put aside for special batches I'll be making. And then there are all the leaves in between that will eventually find a proper purpose and the right buyers. Sitting around baskets outside my house, we women sort a leaf, a leaf, a leaf. I learn who's in love, visiting the flower room, stealing love in the forest, getting married. I hear about petty squabbles. I'm told all the stories I missed during the years I was away. And I get to see how much life has changed for young girls like my three nieces, who tell me about a new government campaign aimed at ethnic minority girls like them to achieve independence, self-strengthening, intelligence, and dexterity. They're supposed to do things like learn to weave handbags with symbols showing their unique culture, but I don't see how that will help them become village cadres, go to college, or start their own small businesses. But when first sister-in-law's daughter recites popular slogans, "Give birth to fewer babies, plant more trees," and "If you give birth to extra children, your family will be ruined," I understand that all three of them are thinking about and planning their lives in ways I clearly didn't at their age. As for Ama, she presides over us in the same way she always did, with a stern but fair hand. She's particularly tough on Deja, who's adept at tea sorting, but has far more important responsibilities ahead of her. "My daughter will need to eat beneficial foods when her baby comes out," Ama says, speaking to Deja as though she's a servant. "Every new Ama needs liver to replenish her lost blood, green papaya to help bring in the milk, and pig kidneys to alleviate her aches and pains. She needs food that will cause warming. Ginger, chicken, and pumpkin. You will make sure the new Ama eats this way for 3 cycles. 36 days and not 1 day less." Deja is illiterate, so she recites recipes to herself as she sorts tea. As for me, I have a different idea of what will happen when my baby is ready to fall to the earth. Although our days are long and it isn't monsoon season, I ask Ama to help me make a proper aka cap for my baby. Soon enough, all the women and girls in the household want to participate. Tonight, we sit together, a variety show on television blaring a pop song, 55 Minorities, One Dream, in the background. The Olympics are coming, and the campaign, to find 55 sets of twins, has inspired pride throughout the country. My three nieces giggle as they peer at my laptop screen, checking websites that post photos featuring the most beautiful girls of the 55 ethnic minorities, and peruse polls asking, "Which of the 55 ethnic minorities has the most beautiful and marriageable girls?" While my sisters-in-law try to remind me of skills I haven't used in years. Third sister-in-law still does the best handiwork, and she's as sharp with her lessons as ever, moving from gentle to cross in seconds depending on how well I'm doing. "Needlework shows a woman's diligence and virtue," she reminds me. "You will want to add coins, dried red chili peppers, and animal teeth to your baby's cap to drive away evil spirits. A well-protected baby should wear at least 10 kilos of silver. Which is not going to happen, but I don't tell her that. And don't forget to add some tiny mirrors, she recommends. Spirits hate to see their own reflections. But when it comes to my embroidery, wah, I'm supposed to incorporate a frog, rabbit, monkey, and cat to show that my baby will be as smart, fast, vibrant, and vigilant as those animals. My eyes sting to see such ugly work, she scolds. You would let your baby be seen in that? Everyone will know his ama doesn't love him. As I pull out my stitches, the other two sisters-in-law try to distract third sister-in-law from her ongoing criticisms by discussing the way the baby is lying within my body. The baby sleeps on wife of Jin's right side, first sister-in-law observes. Surely it's a boy. No, 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 second sister-in-law objects. The baby rests on the left side. Sadly, it's a girl. Third sister-in-law can be easily swayed, and her opinion can shift depending on her mood. One night, my baby is a boy. The next night, she's convinced it's a girl. Tonight, though, she shrewdly asks Ama, What do you think? Ama answers, Anyone can see girl is going to give her husband a son. Later, when Jin and I are alone, I tell him the news, but his reaction is as expected. Boy or girl, he insists, I'll be happy. A healthy baby. That's all we want, isn't it? With each passing day, I love him a little more. My family admires him too because, even though he's a member of the Han majority and I've married outside our tribe, he's respectful of our traditions. Hard work, mutual respect, and a united goal are the threads that now bind Jin, my baby, my family, the people of my village, and me together. After consultations with the headman, Ruma, and Nima, an auspicious date is selected for the annual rebuilding of Springwell Village's Spirit Gate, which includes carving new protective figures of a man and a woman with their giant sex organs, as well as a dog and birds, all made from wood selected by the Ruma for the strength of the tree's souls. The top male of each household participates, and Abba takes Jin along as the head of the household in which I live. We women stay behind, as is required, but the Ruma's voice carries to us through the trees.
Let our spirit gate divert all bad things and make them go around the village, he trumpets. Let our spirit gate chase away the hawk and the tiger. Let it bar seizures and leprosy. Wicked spirits, vampires, and werewolves, see how our male has the strength of iron between his legs to drive you in another direction. Gods, see how fat we've made our female figure. She'll make sure lots of babies will be born in Springwell in the coming year.
Last, he addresses the carved figures directly.
Powerful man! Powerful woman, let all goodness and purity enter. Dog, bite all robbers and those who would wish us harm. Birds, allow riches to come in, but not corrupt us.
The men are done by noon. We celebrate by sacrificing a pig, so the entire village, whether they are of Cité's faction or mine, can share a banquet. Only on the next morning are we women allowed to visit the new gate. But this will not be our only security measure. Jin and I drive to Lao Banjiang to see what the people there are now doing to protect the authenticity of their teas. the headman shows us guard gates and tells us that 3 years of future harvests will be confiscated if someone is found selling counterfeits. So in addition to our traditional spirit gate, the men of Spring Well install an electric gate with a sentry post so that every vehicle that arrives can be inspected to make sure that passengers are not carrying in outside tea, and every vehicle leaving is inspected to make sure that no outside tea has been fraudulently wrapped with our label. Every cake we process is also packaged with a newly required protection ticket, proving where it came from and what it is. After 2 months, all the tea has been processed. Tea Master's son returns home. I hire Teacher Zong to run the business and oversee things when I'm away. He promises to write to Mrs. Chang. Jin, his mother, Deja, and I must go back to Guangzhou so my husband can resume his business without the inconvenience of distance. I can test if the teas we've made are as good as I think they are in my new shop, which I'll open upon my arrival, and Deja and my mother-in-law can fight over who can fret over me more. Following what has become an unspoken tradition, Ama and I visit my grove on my last day on Nanuo Mountain. As Ama picks among the parasites on the mother tree to make her remedies, she has me scrape the yellow threads from the bark into a tiny container. When we're done, we wander through the grove, and I confess to her my wish. "I'd like to come home to have my baby," I say. "I want you to deliver it." She doesn't take a moment to consider.
"I must say no."
"Because it's taboo?" I ask. "You brought Yanye into the world."
"It's not that. I'm honored that you've asked me. But all outside people go to a hospital or clinic to have their babies."
"I'm not an outside person."
"I don't want you to go to just any hospital. I've discussed it with your husband, and he's promised to take you to America to have my grandson."
"What about the taboo of not visiting another village, or else I might have a miscarriage there?"
"You've already traveled a lot with the baby inside you."
"But Spring Well is my childhood home, and I want you to deliver."
"Girl, you need to have your baby in America for 2 reasons. First, so you'll be near Yanye. Maybe in her heart she'll learn she has a brother. And second, to give your son American citizenship. Anyone who can afford it does it. Even I know that."
"Will you come with us?" The silver charms and coins on Ama's headdress tinkle and twitter as she shakes her head.
"I need to stay here in case someone gets sick. And a baby is due to arrive soon in Shelter Shadow Village. I could never let that bride go through delivery with just her mother-in-law to help her."
Later, Ama gives me things to take to the American hospital in case they don't have proper medications. Monkey callus, for the doctor to rub on my back if the labor settles there. Pangolin shell, to massage my stomach to help contract my womb after the birth. The filings off a bear's claw in case I bleed badly. And a special weed to put between my legs after the delivery to help heal up my end.
"If your baby gets an eye infection, squeeze a little of your breast milk into his eye," she advises. "Do they have malaria over there? You already know the treatment, but I made a weak poultice for a newborn, just in case."
The opening of my new shop goes splendidly well. Within days, my 3 tea men are back, too. It's wonderful to see them again, and they banter with me about the size of my belly and which of their names I will choose to name my baby. Sweetly funny. Obviously, this wasn't the best time to start a new business, but so many people are relying on me, and tea picking and selling follows its own schedule. So, just 2 weeks after saying goodbye to Ama in our grove, I leave the care of my shop in the hands of my mother-in-law. The next day, Jin, Deja, and I take a flight to California. 1 week later, on the morning of May 15 in the Western calendar, I go into labor. When we arrive at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, Jin fills out the paperwork, and I'm wheeled into a labor room. Deja promised Ama not to leave my side, but within minutes, she's out in the hallway arguing with Jin, who promised me not to leave my side.
If a husband sees his wife give birth, he may die from it,
I hear Deja squealing like an irate sow. My husband's voice comes through the walls, low, calm, and insistent. In the end, they both stay with me. I'm glad for their company and support, but this is so far from Aka tradition that together we vow never to tell Ama. The hospital staff is patient with us, but how can anyone argue with Jin and Win?
If my wife says she needs to drink hot water to help the baby come out,
he tells the nurse,
then get her some hot water. If after the birth my wife needs to have a shell rubbed on her abdomen,
he tells the doctor,
then this is what will happen.
But when Deja lays out a piece of indigo cloth on the side table and places a knife, some string, and an egg on it, Jin pulls out his wallet and tries to palm money into the doctor's hand.
I'm just trying to see to your wife, sir, the doctor says stiffly. That kind of thing is not necessary.
The contractions become more intense. Jin keeps saying,
breathe, breathe, breathe,
because it's something he's seen in movies. I love him, but in the worst moments, I rely on Deja. She helps me into a squatting position. I feel very high on the bed. The doctors and nurses try to crowd in, but she elbows them out of the way.
Remember what your ama said about the fish?
Deja reminds me.
Just let your son slip out.
One more push, and whoop!
Will you please let me see the baby?
The doctor begs.
I'd like to clear his airway.
Is it a boy? I ask. Jin answers, a big smile on his face.
Yes, it's a boy.
I edge away from the baby and ease myself back onto the mattress with my legs on either side of him. He's covered with slime, of course, but he's got a full head of black hair. His skin is pink and full of life, and between his legs are the three swollen things that will make me a grandmother one day. Deja's lips move as she silently counts. 10 toes, 10 fingers, 2 arms.
Will someone tell this woman to move?
The doctor demands. Deja doesn't speak English, and Jin doesn't know what must happen next. In a minute, please, I manage. A baby is not truly born until it has cried 3 times. The doctor sighs and backs off a step. With each of my baby's strong wails, Deja speaks the ritual words.
The first cry is for blessing. The second cry is for the soul. The third cry is for his lifespan.
Then she motions for the doctor and nurse to come forward. She clips the umbilical cord and allows Jin to tie the string we brought below the clip. Then, snip, a push, and the friend living with child comes out in an easy whoosh. Deja hands me the heart-forget egg to eat, but already I'm forgetting the pains of childbirth. I feel tired, but euphoric. The doctor takes my son to another table, where she and one of the nurses check his Apgar score. He's perfect. When I'm allowed to bring him to my breast, I whisper into his face, "The 4 great spirits are the sun, moon, sky, and earth. But you also must learn about the lesser spirits who guide the wind, lightning, waterfalls, lakes, and springs. Everything on earth has a soul, even a single rice kernel. Jin punches in the number for Abba's new cell phone and hands it to Deja, who makes the announcement in Akka.
The family will have game to eat now,
meaning I've given birth to a son. Abba's hollers come all the way through the phone to my bed. In the middle of the night, Jin goes down the hall to watch as our baby is circumcised by Dr. Katz, a pediatrician recommended to us because he sees a lot of Chinese children. 2 mornings later, we're ready to be discharged, but we can't leave the hospital until we've given a woman on staff a name to write on my baby's birth certificate.
Paul William Chang will be his American name, Jin announces.
Baby Paul, wearing the cap I made, is tucked into his car seat, and we go home. Deja follows us upstairs and into Jin's and my room. He pulls back the covers and props up the pillows so I can rest on the bed with the baby. Deja clucks and frets. But when Jin climbs on the bed next to me so we can gaze into our baby's face together, she starts darting from one side of the room to the other in agitation.
What's wrong, Deja? Jin asks.
She refuses to look at Jin and sends her words to me in rapid Akka so he can't possibly follow.
The rules say that a husband and wife may not sleep on the same mat together for 10 cycles. 120 days. Because if you get pregnant again and another baby is born within a year, it will be considered.
She is so distraught, she can't finish the sentence. Remembering the taboo, I'm filled with sorrow for her. A baby born within a year of an older brother or sister is considered a twin. Deja, come. I pat the mattress, and she sits down reluctantly. I understand your worry, but I'm not going to sleep apart from Jin.
What about the intercourse? She whispers.
I just had a baby.
Men are forbidden from trying to attempt the intercourse at this time for the reasons you know, and to give the wife time to recover in her parts,
she persists.
But a man is a man, and 10 cycles lasts a very long time.
I smile. Don't worry. Jin and I will be fine. She finally relents, up to a point. She goes out for a walk and comes back with lengths of ivy ripped from Rosie's yard.
I can't find magic vine, so this will have to do.
She drapes the leafy strings on our front door and on the door to the nursery to bar baby-attacking spirits. After this, she shyly returns to my room. She pulls out from under her tunic a clear plastic bag with something red and squishy, with a long, eel-like thing floating inside.
I took the friend living with child when the man at the hospital wasn't looking! She practically crows.
You stole my placenta? I ask, which causes Jin to look up. My husband, who's been brave throughout, goes as white as sand when she flops it carelessly on the bedside table.
I'm going to bury it under the house, beneath where you keep the family altar. Your son can't be separated from it. And don't worry. I'll take all the responsibility for watering it twice daily until it shrivels to nothing.
Later, she comes back covered in cobwebs and dirt from the crawl space. The next morning, we do our best to perform an Akka naming ceremony. I should have bought a rooster and raised it for Jin to sacrifice. Deja has pestered me endlessly about this. Instead, Jin goes to a butcher shop in Monterey Park, watches a chicken get killed and cleaned, and brings it home. After Deja cooks the meal, She dips 3 strings in each dish, then ties them around Jin's, the baby's, and my wrists so we'll never be separated for long. Then she picks up my son and recites,
"Get big! Be strong! Don't cry! May your crops be good and your animals healthy."
The name Jin has only one syllable, so we name our baby Jin Ba.
"I hope he'll be the first in a long line," Jin says.
My feelings about Akka superstitions have wavered from the time I was a little girl, and they're part of what drove me to ask for Teacher Zhang's help so many years ago. But if even one of Deja's precautions will make Paul safe, then I'll never object. And I'll teach him the right traditions, like never crossing his legs near adults, and when thunder comes, dumplings must be made. I'll whisper in his ear that spirits are not too smart, and all the ways to fool them. I'll tell him that earthquakes are caused when a dragon living underground pulls at roots and shakes them, and that lunar eclipses are caused by a spirit dog eating the moon. I'll tell him stories about Amma Mata, the mother of humans and spirits, and how she divided the world. And, of course, I'll teach him to recite the lineage, even if it's only for my family and not his father's. 2 months later, Jin, Deja, and I eat dinner in front of the television so we can watch the opening ceremonies of the Olympics taking place in Beijing. I rub a little food from our meal on Paul's lips to let him know we are eating, but really, we are all distracted, mesmerized by the pageant our homeland is mounting for the world. The parade of twins from China's 55 ethnic minorities looks to be made up mostly of Han-majority people dressed to look like minorities. Nevertheless, Deja cries at the spectacle. Jin says the most beautiful of all China's women are Akka, but what else can he say? And I contentedly hold my son. The next few months in Arcadia are the happiest of my life. Jin's an ambitious and busy father. I've helped my village, and my new shop in the Fengcheng Tea Market is doing moderately well, giving me hope that the value of poor will return. I'm 30 years old. I love my son more than my own life. I'll do anything for him. So, personally, I've bounced back once again. But during this same time, world economies have been faltering. Now, they take a deep dive. By the end of the year, property values in the United States and China have fallen into a chasm. All across the globe, people close their purses and fold up their wallets. Everyone is so scared that they stop buying toys, air conditioners, flat-screen televisions, and all manners of goods that would be shipped in cardboard. We are unsure if Jin's company will make it through this difficult period. But as Mrs. Chang reminds us on the phone one afternoon, "You and Jin are fortunate to have a son in the era of the one-child policy." That is what gives Jin the strength to fight for his business, and me the determination to help him as he has helped me.
Part 5. The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, 2012 through 2016. Assignment. In AP English, we've been focusing on writing essays in preparation for the college applications you'll be writing next year. Now I'd like to take a different approach by exploring your images with a short story. No groans, please. Writers are often told to write what they know. Take something that happened to you and reimagine it as a piece of fiction. You may write in the first or third person. You may also change the names if you feel that will give you more freedom. Submissions will be read only by me. Please remember that for your college apps, everyone does a sport, aspires to be a doctor, or writes about their parents' immigrant experience to America. You can't get in with these cliched topics on your applications. Be creative, expand your minds, and let's see if you can come up with something that will be translatable to a college essay designed to make you stand out. Due October 13th, 2012. The Disappointment by Haley Davis. On a dark night in March, Adam and Alice Bowen sat their daughter Amy down for a talk. Was it going to be another lecture about not raiding the liquor cabinet? Or concerned inquiries about what was happening in therapy? Or would it be the same old, how was school today? How did you do on your AP chemistry test? Did you finish your homework? Were they going to tell her they were separating, which honestly wouldn't have surprised Amy one bit? Maybe her dad had been diagnosed with cancer or needed open-heart surgery. This would have terrified Amy, but wouldn't have surprised her either because her dad was already pretty old when she was adopted. Instead, when Adam began, "This summer..." Amy's hopes flew through the roof. Were they finally going to relent and let her go to Europe with her friends by themselves? "We're taking you to China. We want you to discover your roots." That was about the last thing in the world Amy wanted or would have asked for, really. Because who would want to go on a family vacation at her age? But what can you do? Fight against it, that's what. "I'm not going on one of those stupid heritage tours," she said. Once upon a time, she would have loved to have gone to China. She'd wanted to get information about the object she'd been found with. Most babies abandoned in China were left with a special gift from their birth mothers, a locket, a good luck charm, a hand-knit sweater or hand-sewn quilt, maybe even a little Chinese money. Amy knew this because she had seen those things in pictures. Some new mom and dad posing with their baby and holding up her little gift like it was a soccer trophy. Amy's memento from her birth mother, however, was a little unusual. A round cake of tea, decorated with meaningless symbols and weighing about a pound. When Amy was little, she used to take it out every night and stare at it. It had to mean something, but what? Then there'd been this incident in the second grade when she'd done a project and told everyone in the entire school and their parents that she was the first person in her family to come to America. It was the truth, but she'd caused her adoptive parents' pain, which hadn't been her intention at all. Amy had gotten really scared. Would they send her away? She still struggled with her identity and sometimes searched the internet to see if she could find anything about her birth mother or the tea cake. In secret, because she'd never forgotten the repercussions of the second grade episode. She didn't want to hurt her parents again, but they just weren't getting it. After all, what did they think she'd get out of a trip to China now? She wouldn't find her roots, she wouldn't get any answers about the tea cake or her identity, and, here was the kicker, the trip would make her feel worse. She already ached with loss over her birth mother. Traveling to China would be no help. Besides, practically all the girls she knew who'd been adopted had already gone there with Roots and Shoots Heritage Tours, a company that specialized in expeditions for families with adoptees, so a trip like this wouldn't make her special or anything. She was merely a part of a big wave that had brought thousands of girls like her to these shores. Pretty weird, pretty sad, and no big deal. "Have we ever taken you on a tour anywhere?" Alice asked. "We don't do tours, you know that." "But this might be the last time we all travel together," Adam said, and again Amy flashed that something might be wrong with him. "After you graduate, you'll probably want to go on a trip with your friends. Damn straight. And after that, you'll likely be spending your vacations in a lab somewhere, or out in the field, or helping some scientists change the way we view the world, like your mom." "Oh, Adam." It went on like that, some stupid love fest, but Amy didn't put up much of a fuss, because what if this was the last vacation they all took together? Still, did it have to be China? Why not go back to the south of France, or do something new, like hike the outback? And, of course, once the itinerary came in, Amy saw how her parents were shaping the trip to be a heritage tour, even if it wasn't called a heritage tour, because their last stop before flying home would be Yunnan Province, where she was born. The Bowen family left LAX at night. They were all half-dead by the time they landed in Beijing 13 hours later. They went through passport control and customs. Then they pushed through a set of double doors and, oh my God! Always, Amy had felt like the one Chinese face in a sea of white faces. Now, here were a bazillion people who looked like her, and it was her parents who stood out. They spotted a young woman holding a card with the Bowen name printed on it. She introduced herself as their Beijing guide, and her English was pretty pathetic. She wore a wrinkled skirt, a little white blouse, and scuffed shoes. A super cheap plastic purse hung off her shoulder. She led the way through the writhing throng with her arm extended to clear a path for the mismatched threesome. Amy was 17, but she clung to her mom like you wouldn't believe. They went through another set of doors, and it was like stepping into an oven. Truly. Like you got a baking sheet already with cookie dough, and your mom was going to let you slide it in the oven, but when you did, all you could think about was Hansel and Gretel and the way the witch wanted to cook them. People pushed and shoved as they loaded their suitcases, beat-up cardboard boxes, and these satchel things made out of some kind of plastic woven material in red, white, and blue into trunks, the underbellies of buses, even onto the roofs of cars. They shouted. They noisily sucked junk from their noses, coughed, and spit on the ground. It was beyond gross. And the smell? Too much garlic. Like Amy had landed in a gigantic mouth with really bad breath. Add to that too much sweat and too much cigarette smoke wafting off people's clothes. Nasty. Honey, Alice said, you're cutting off my circulation. Amy loosened her grip on her mother's hand, but not by much. They piled into a minivan. The guide sat up front with the driver, who didn't say a single word. The traffic? It was crazy, and it was the middle of the night. They crept past apartment buildings, gray with dim fluorescent lights illuminating a room here and there. It took Amy a while to figure out what was hanging out all the windows, bamboo sticks draped with laundry. They arrived at the hotel, and it was ginormous and super fancy. Adam handed over their passports and his credit card. A uniformed boy put their luggage on a cart and escorted the family to connecting rooms. Alice and Adam were excited, talking nonstop about all the things they were going to do. Suddenly, Alice stopped mid-sentence to stare at her daughter. "Do you have to sneer?" she asked. "We're doing this trip for you." Later, after she got in bed, Amy heard her mother say, "Teenagers." A part of Amy wanted her dead. When Amy woke the next morning, she was disoriented because her mom was still talking about everything she and Adam had planned, except now she was wearing shorts, a t-shirt, and a Dodgers baseball cap. Amy was so embarrassed she wanted to pull the covers back over her head, but that wasn't on the itinerary. An hour later, showered, fed, and sunscreen slathered on every exposed piece of skin, they left the hotel. The air outside was disgusting. By the time Amy got to the minivan, her arms were totally wet. No one could sweat that fast, but there was so much moisture in the air that it was like someone had sprayed her with hot water. And it was only 9 in the morning. They walked across one blisteringly hot square or courtyard after another, the Temple of Heaven, Tiananmen Square, the Forbidden City. The sun glared down. Adam asked the guide how hot it was. She answered, "The government gives people the day off if it goes over 40 degrees centigrade." He asked, "So again, how hot is it today?" She gazed across the square like she wasn't with the Bowens. "I heard it was going to be 44 degrees centigrade and 80% humidity." Adam whistled. Alice sighed. Amy took the trouble to make the calculation to Fahrenheit. 111 degrees! Adam bought bottles of water. The Bowens drank and sweat some more. Adam took Amy's picture about 1,000 times. She saw more people from around the world in the first hour than she had in her entire life. And then there were the Chinese. They were everywhere. Since the weather was so gross, Amy ended up changing her clothes 3 times every day, even her bra and panties. The Bowens visited more tourist spots, the Summer Palace, the Great Wall of China, the Tomb Soldiers in Xi'an, the Bund in Shanghai. China was strange, though. It didn't have much connection to what she'd learned about it and families with children from China, or even from going to her friends Jasmine's and Jade's houses.